And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm so pleased to have with me across the table for today's morning show, Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, who joins us once a month on a regular basis to offer up his insightful analysis of events here and abroad. And as usual, there is no shortage, but today there is especially no shortage of really interesting things to be talking about. So, Professor Sear, it's great to welcome you back to the morning show.
It's always nice to be here, Greg. It's the one day a month I can't just sit around, sleep late, wander through the neighborhood.
Right.
Got to get up early and be focused. Thank you very much.
Well, there's at least 2 days you have to do that, because I know about that often you're also on WUWM, and whenever I get to hear you on Lake Effect, it's always fun to hear that as well, although you don't get to talk as long with them. It's typically a little briefer visit, and we get to really talk
at
great
length.
That's a very
good point. Yeah, I'll try to get them to let me talk longer.
More Art Sear all the time.
I'll quote you, yes.
Very good. Well, as I said, there are a lot of things to be talking about, and I think we should probably actually begin our conversation in Washington, a very lively place right now. And, of course, one of the matters that has garnered an enormous amount of attention is this letter signed by 47 Republicans sent to the government of Iran in what would seem to be an effort to undermine the Obama administration's efforts to broker some kind of nuclear deal with the nation of Iran. First of all, ahead of us hearing from you on what you think of that, maybe you could summarize to the best of your ability what your understanding about exactly what precipitated those Republicans to make that move, and how unprecedented that gesture, in fact, was. I mean, have we ever seen anything like that before?
Well, we have seen things like that throughout our history. What the Republicans were trying to communicate was their disdain for the president. It was a way of slapping him in the face in a very public way. They were trying to reinforce ties with AIPAC and the Israel lobby more generally in the United States. And they were trying to generate publicity for themselves. And a few of them may actually have been interested in furthering American national security and our diplomatic position in the world, but I don't believe that was the major motivation.
What in this letter, what were they conveying as far as their primary concerns about any such any potential deal between the United States and Iran?
Well, you're getting at the substantive point, and I was obviously editorializing. The senators wanted to make clear that for binding treaties, the Senate has advice and consent authority constitutionally. They were reminding the world generally. This was a publicly released letter. I don't believe they sent it by postal mail or courier to the Ayatollah in Iran to whom it was addressed. But, you know, the fact that it was directed to the Ayatollah rather than President Rouhani, again, to me, underscores the grandstanding nature of the political stunt. They made the point that a future president certainly won't be bound by anything that Obama agrees to. I obviously have my own views and biases. I believe Secretary Kerry did a very good, a former member of the Senate quite recently, did a very good job, a very lawyerly job of responding to assertions in the letter.
You, in your column, actually say that the White House made the situation, I mean, that being this kind of divisive stalemate, if we want to call it that, made the situation worse in the letter which they themselves fired off to Bob Corker. Tell us about that response and why you thought it was, at least to some extent, misguided.
Well, it seemed as childish as the Senate gesture from my Olympian heights here in academia. It was not from President Obama. It was from the Chief of Staff of the White House. There were seven Republicans, courageous Republicans in my view, very good senators, including Bob Corker, the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, who did not sign the Republican letter, and the White House sent the letter to him. I believe, like I said at the start, the president's disdain and open disdain for Republicans in Congress and his aloofness from the congressional process throughout his tenure, but it seems to me to be getting a lot worse in terms of attitude and gesture and treatment. That has precipitated. That's a lot of the incentive for the Republicans to behave the way they did. I think the letter, if they want to do their own stunt, it should have been from the president. It should have been addressed to the Republican majority leader, Mitch McConnell, who did sign the letter and is responsible for these antics, not the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, who actually gets high marks, and I'm sure even the White House is aware of this. Corker gets good marks for being a pragmatist, for working across the aisle. He avoids grandstanding. It's a particularly important and potentially extremely influential committee, the Foreign Relations Committee, showing the continuing importance of foreign policy to our politics, contrary to conventional wisdom and the dominant themes in the public media today. And Corker is in a position to have a very powerful impact of a positive sort, in my view, on our politics as well as foreign policy. And for the White House to put him on the spot, I'm no big-time politician, I'm just a simple professor, but it sure as hell doesn't make much sense.
I am a little surprised to hear you say that this wasn't an unprecedented gesture on the part of the Republicans, just because it's been painted that way in the media. And, of course, the media likes to take a lot of things and sort of exaggerate their significance. But it sounded almost like you would characterize this as just kind of more of the same, just the latest in a long series.
No, I did say there is some precedent, but it's not more of the same. It's pretty extreme. Members of Congress are always firing off letters and press releases and this and that. They're shooting all the time.
Right.
Sometimes blanks. But to actually answer your question, there was a gentleman by the name of Logan at the end of the 18th century, early in the days of our fine republic, an M.D. in Pennsylvania, I believe, who started doing his own diplomacy with France at a time of difficult relations between the Federalists, John Adams' administration, I think, and France, and things weren't quite so bad with the British. We'd ended the war, and the War of 1812 hadn't started yet, and they weren't impressing quite as many seamen as they started to. Anyway, Logan was able to leverage the notoriety he got and the hostility from the White House. I believe he was elected to the U.S. Senate. He was certainly elected to Congress. And people who don't know much else about the subject, including me, will quote the Logan Act because Adams was sufficiently incensed that the Federalists in Congress passed a law that private citizens can't engage in diplomacy on behalf of the United States. And the Logan Act has been mentioned in the media because people generally will tend to know about it. And it was used once, very early in the 1800s, to prosecute another daring, certainly adventurous, kind of nutty guy who was trying to get the French to go along with a succession of some part of Kentucky or some western area from the U.S. I believe that's the only case in which it was used. I don't believe Abraham Lincoln, when half the United States was desperately trying to develop foreign alliances, especially with Britain, and nearly succeeded. I don't believe he brought up that act. He did other things that were very skillful, and thank God he kept the British out of the war on behalf of the Confederates. But it's mentioned more in the media context and public discussion than in fact, but it did underscore that constitutionally the chief executive, the president, and the administration conduct our foreign affairs, in particular through the often beleaguered State Department, which brings up a precedent that's much more important. Early in the Eisenhower administration, there was a strong effort by Republicans in Congress, and he, of course, was part of that party, although in significant ways he was above partisanship, a strong effort to amend the Constitution, to bring up several constitutional amendments that would embed the Congress in diplomacy. The president couldn't do anything without working hand in glove with the Congress. It was a recipe for disaster, obviously. It was during the time of McCarthyism, anti-communist hysteria, the intense bitter feelings between the Truman administration and the Republicans who captured the Congress during Eisenhower's first 2 years. John Bricker, a right-wing isolationist senator from Ohio, who had been the vice presidential nominee with Tom Dewey in 44, was promoting this. The most important fact is Eisenhower worked day and night with his very effective staff, mostly behind the scenes as usual, to defeat the Bricker Amendment. It was defeated by exactly one vote
Wow.
in the U.S. Senate. And Ike was the great magician and the great deceiver in positive ways, in my opinion. He's very blunt in writing that this was the most painful and most difficult domestic policy decision he had to deal with in the White House. And it was, as Wellington said about Waterloo, it was a damn near run thing. For all this phenomenal effort, we almost lost.
Wow. And just
meaning the American people, if the Bricker Amendment had gone in.
Yeah. Just think of what that might have changed in years to come.
That's right. And it would have undercut Ike drastically at the beginning and from within his own party.
Wow. Fascinating.
Yeah, as usual, I've talked too long probably, but this is a really important point to get across because a cocktail party and parlor game foreign policy experts will bring up the Logan Act, but the Bricker Amendment seems to be forgotten. A lot of Republicans wanted to forget about it as soon as possible after Eisenhower finally, as usual, prevailed.
Wow. One more thing about this matter in this particular column that you were writing about this letter to the leaders of Iran and so on, you quote a foreign affairs and security advisor to President Carter, Mr. Brzezinski, making some observations that you find quite compelling about Iran and some of the really fundamental problems. Excuse the pun, that we need to be aware of and keep in mind when we think about matters like brokering a treaty with them.
You're referring to the blog post that actually we're anticipating the column. It'll be in the Kenosha News and a number of other papers next Monday and early next week.
Oh, so we're scooping it.
And over the weekend, yeah. This is the Monday column in the Kenosha News for those who are interested. Brzezinski, I think Carter was remarkably successful in Mideast diplomacy. He gets almost no credit, especially from the irritating Israelis. Brzezinski is always interesting. Sometimes, from my point of view, he's on target, he's off target. He has set a very good example of maintaining an extremely active professional life for many years after his Washington stint. And he has tremendous imagination, and he has written that Iran over time could evolve into a version of Turkey, which is constitutionally a secular state, but now has an Islamic government. There is the potential for radicalism. Their history has been much more secular, obviously, than Iran's, but Iran did have the precedent of the Shah, and he felt that if we handle things skillfully over time, we could be dealing with a more moderate Iran. And to me, that's his imagination in a persuasive direction.
The moment we're talking foreign policy and domestic politics at the same time, let's remain.
I think that's good.
Yeah, they go hand in hand, of course. Let's talk about a couple other kind of domestic matters, and then we'll shift even more decisively abroad. Let's talk about the Obama administration. A lot of observers and analysts are talking about this sort of latter part of the second term, which we usually think of as kind of the lame duck session, as actually a moment in time in which President Obama appears to be on the offensive and actually accomplishing more than has been the case earlier. I mean, that's actually overstating it. I'm just trying to characterize the way a lot of analysts and pundits seem to be talking about President Obama, that in the wake of the Republicans' sweeping of Capitol Hill, that has somehow been a a catalyst for President Obama to, in fact, as I said, go on the offensive in terms of policy. Is that the way you see it at the moment?
Well, you said policy, and I'd say no. The president is most comfortable and I believe considers himself most effective when he's campaigning. He's demonstrably a brilliant campaigner who went a tremendous, very impressive long distance in politics in a very short period of time. He is certainly on the road even more than before. He seems to be always on the road. And if you look at the White House daily schedule, which is present on the web, it's revealing. The campaign mode is not really the same as being the chief executive of the country.
Hmm.
If you do take a look at the White House daily schedule, I find it helpful to keep in mind, getting back to Eisenhower, at the Kennedy Library, ironically, in a replica of the Oval Office in Boston, I saw they'd laid out JFK's daily schedule for a period of time, and you could flip through it in Eisenhower's daily schedule. And with Ike, from 8:30 in the morning till 6 o'clock in the evening, there was a rigorous schedule of meetings that would usually last no longer than an hour, dealing with basically the full array of the federal government. He was an unusual political leader in that he was also a very skillful chief executive, and it's very hard to find both. But to me, that kind of schedule is the ideal. President Truman was the same way, and so was George H.W. Bush and others, Nixon. But I don't believe that the president is finding effectiveness in that dimension. Every president, including Eisenhower, has trouble in his second term if he's elected to a second term in office. And in that sense, the president, I think, is going to be increasingly beleaguered. He is up in the polls, which is the other thing. All politicians from before they were born, they're sensitive to the vibrations of the public, and the White House is rightly trumpeting the fact that he's up back to around 50%.
Right. Well, and other numbers, too, that they can point to include an unemployment rate that's the lowest that it's been in, well, then since before this great recession hit, I believe.
It's taken a long time, yeah. Well, obviously, the economy didn't sink him in 2012.
Right.
And we are doing better, thank God.
Mm-hmm. Politically, one of the most interesting stories lately has been the story about Hillary Clinton. And
story about Hillary Clinton?
Well, I'm of course thinking of the story of these emails and the fact that she appears to have melded professional and personal emails all together into one account, to something to the great consternation of quite a lot of people. What is your reaction to that?
I think it is a serious political issue in the sense that a big challenge for her, every presidential aspirant has major challenges, she has to convince the electorate that she is actively and aggressively running for president, and she is not waiting to become queen. She needs to show that she does not have a sense of entitlement and being above it all, which is a problem for a lot of people who want to be president, but in her case, it's a special problem and not just related to gender. Hmm. Well, I do believe we will have a woman president soon. It may well be her. I tend to think, and she's way ahead in the polls, as you indicated off the air, I think the less difficult route is the Margaret Thatcher route. I'm running not because of my husband's name recognition. I'm running because of what I have done on my own as a leader in government, including the legislative branch. That model is not hers.
Right. What about this specific matter, this criticism she's been barraged with about this matter of the emails? I mean, is that a tempest in a teapot, or was that a serious error in judgment on her part? I mean, I don't mean just an error because a lot of people are upset about it, but in fact, did it represent some kind of gross lapse in judgment? I mean, was she in some way risking important information in that decision, or do we not?
Oh, she may have been. I don't think it's a serious national security threat. It's a tempest in a teapot, but a lot of politics is that. Mitt Romney, when he had a very difficult trip to Britain, when he was gearing up for the Maine 2012 campaign, in the interest of being clever, his organization, off the record, put out the statement that Anglo-American culture, Anglo-Saxon culture is really vital to our partnership. And it is. Well, that's where we get the rule of law and representative government and Downton Abbey, all Sherlock Holmes, lots of great things from the Anglo-Saxons across the Atlantic. But the media in Britain and then in this country seized on this as implying elitism and even racism, which is absurd. But political campaigns are often absurd. I think that Hillary Clinton has, in hindsight, which is 2020, she should have been more professional and more orderly. And I'm kind of old and out of date, but I do believe you can have more than one email account on the same portable electronic device, and that a little technical assistance might have been very helpful for her now.
To say that,
yeah, but crazy things become. Republicans attacked FDR, allegedly because he sent a destroyer back to pick up his little dog, Falla. Now, Falla was a wonderful political prop that FDR had used for years. He was a very particularly photogenic dog. And, Roosevelt went on and on about the attacks on Falla.
Mm.
I can take it, my wife can, but Falla is mad. And he turned it into this narrative that was hilarious and also extremely useful for him.
Right. Well, and as I recall, that happened late in his third term, or maybe during his fourth campaign for president. And this was at a time
during the war.
Right.
Excuse me.
And later in the war. And this was at a time when there's some concerns are being raised about FDR aging and maybe not continuing to be fully equipped for the job. And this was a real shining moment where the old FDR wit and energy showed through.
Good point. Yeah, very good point. Thank you.
Are you surprised at Hillary Clinton's vigorous poll numbers right now?
I think she's been consistently polling very high. And we'll see when the campaign actually starts. She may just go on to get the nomination by acclamation, and my comments about running for queen will be totally off the wall and not worth remembering at all, and she may win by an FDR-type landslide.
Hmm.
But name recognition in a general sense, I would not equate her in any human or personal sense with Ted Kennedy, who I believe had considerable strengths and redeemed himself in his later years from some very serious demonstrated flaws. But in 80, when he challenged a sitting president, very brave thing to do, Jimmy Carter, Kennedy was way ahead of Carter. And the media was focused on Ted Kennedy versus, of course, the guy who would almost certainly be the Republican nominee, John Connally.
Mm.
Now, it turned out, in fact, to be Carter against Reagan, and we can talk about why. But the media focus and the poll favorites early on don't in any way determine an election. And we're still pretty early on, even though a lot of Americans are pretty sick of all the coverage.
Isn't that something? We haven't even begun, really. It's fascinating. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clawson Center at Carthage College, Clawson Distinguished Professor of World Political Economy and World Business?
Oh. Very good. That's
okay.
Good.
Another couple
of years, we'll really have it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's turn our attention abroad and, of course, to a couple of incidents, violent incidents, and very, very disturbing on several different fronts. One of them involving a really frightening attack on U.S. Ambassador Mark Lippert, which that occurred in Seoul, South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
The other, an out-and-out murder, which occurred in Russia, which would seem to be an indication of just what a dangerous place that is.
Yeah, politicians have far greater risks there. And
right.
Actually, I'm not joking.
Right, right. Let's talk first about the U.S. Ambassador Mark Lippert. And, of course, this was a shocking thing indeed, particularly because it occurred in Seoul, South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who maybe didn't follow the story closely or don't even remember its details, just recap what exactly happened with the ambassador and what we know about who was responsible.
At luncheon where he was speaking in Seoul, South Korea, about 2 weeks ago, Ambassador Lippert was attacked with a knife or a razor by a crazed, deranged fanatic who was hoping to kill him and was hoping to do I don't know what, generate notoriety for himself, but also to spark a change in South Korea so they'd be reunified with the North. Fortunately, the ambassador survived. I must say he's given what he went through. He's handled the situation very well. He was conscious of his public role and made a very very appropriate, I must say, remarkably lucid statement under the circumstances when the attack, right after the attack. And then when he left the hospital a few days ago, I don't believe he was ever in serious danger, but he was really very badly slashed, and it could have been life-threatening. He had a very articulate press conference. He handled the whole thing extremely well, and American diplomats almost always do. He's somebody who, he's still in his 40s, he's had a remarkable career. He's been very influential in the Obama administration, including, I believe, the campaign time. He's a military veteran, I believe, of Iraq. It shows the importance of this particular post. We consistently send people with very, very strong and diverse credentials to that job, and it shows how important the ambassadorship in South Korea is. Mm. And in that sense, it underscores the importance of that vital ally for us in Asia. Mm. As you know, I think South Korea is particularly important for us for historical reasons, and this incident, I believe, underscores it.
Yeah. In your column where you talked about this incident, as you described the vigor of the South Korean economy, I was really taken aback because you kind of mentioned a number of different sectors, four or five different areas in which South Korea is really a worldwide leader. And I just never even realized that their strength was, in a sense, so diversified. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about.
A lot of primary industrial products, essential building blocks to a modern capitalist economy, shipbuilding, steel, even though they're one of the largest and richest economies in the world, companies are still able to make money in shipbuilding. Other major industrial nations, including Japan and the U.S., except by national plan for security reasons, we're not really in the shipbuilding business anymore. Cars, of course, everybody's aware of that. Pullman Motors has a very rich and, I'm sure, profitable partnership with Kia. It's visible right here in Kenosha, in Racine. Advanced electronics of all sorts. It's an impressive combination of industries. And they, of course, have gone from being one of the poorest economies in the world as recently as the 60s to being, depending on how you measure it, the number 11, 12, 15 economy in the world. It's remarkably rapid industrialization, in many ways unprecedented. One of our good political economy students doing his senior thesis, Isaac Smith, has been developing information on the role of international organizations in developing Korea. It was his idea. It makes perfect sense. They're the only nation that was both a recipient of assistance from the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and then turned around very quickly and became a major donor. Hmm. A poor country that became a rich country with almost unbelievable speed.
Hmm. Interesting. And, of course, one of the most interesting things about South Korea is how its culture and economy play out in one way, and then right across that border is North Korea, and one of the most striking contrasts you're going to find probably any place on the planet. I mean,
no.
Two different worlds, nearly two different planets, really, between North and South.
Two different planets is a good way of putting it. Immediately after the very vicious attack on the ambassador, Pyongyang Radio had a very vicious, crazy announcement that this had happened and celebrating the news. And then very quickly, perhaps within hours, certainly within a day or two, they had made very explicit that they had no connection with this attack, showing that even the last remaining totally committed communists have to face reality in this world. Even these intense totalitarians who have a crazy regime in many ways have to face reality. They couldn't associate themselves with this kind of act in this day and age.
Right. That brings us to the other violent incident, which involved actually the out-and-out murder of Boris Nemtsov, who was a very important leader of the opposition against President Vladimir Putin in Russia. You tell us he was the very influential leader of something called, I think, the Republican Party of Russia, People's Freedom Party.
Gets a little complicated.
Right. But he was a significant figure there. And this is important to note, not just that he himself was gunned down in cold blood in, was it broad daylight? On a Moscow street?
Not far from the Kremlin.
Right. But also that he's not the first open critic of President Putin to be assassinated. Just what kind of a history are we talking about there?
Well, the article mentions a series of incidents. There are lots of critics of Putin and his regime in Russia who are still walking around, but highly visible people who have influence, a young woman, journalist, representing a major reformist newspaper not far from the Kremlin in broad daylight, was gunned down, I believe, in 2009. She was going to aid a civil liberties lawyer. He had become a great thorn in the side of the Putin regime. And he was murdered. These are hitmen with, you know, weapons with silencers, and they're not crazed lunatics. They're men who know what they're doing and do it for this kind of thing for a living. Lest we be too self-righteous and superior in the U.S., it was into the 30s and 40s that we had not regular political assassinations in this country, but organized crime, the mafia, gangsters really did play a very prominent role in the American economy and in American politics. I think Russia, I believe, is going to evolve out of this. Putin himself has not been directly linked to the Nemtsov murder, the one I just mentioned, or others. People accuse him of it, but there's endless speculation in any assassination where the evidence is not crystal clear at the start. There's speculation that another far right group killed Mr. Nemtsov and as a way of trying to discredit Putin. Conspiracy theories, as with JFK, again referring to our system, they become endless. There have been prosecutions in most cases of the half dozen or so murders in the 21st century of this type, and men have gone to prison. The legal system operates clearly with some independence from the Kremlin because the Supreme Court has intervened at least once to make sure aggressive prosecution was pursued. And I believe in the case of the journalist and lawyer I just mentioned, men have been convicted in something like due process and have gone to prison. So it's not the Third Reich. It's not the old-fashioned communist regime.
Right.
It's not North Korea.
It's not a lawless environment we're talking about.
No. And Putin, of course, is quick publicly to denounce these kinds of crimes.
Right. In the course of this column, you make another observation about Russia, which probably is worth mentioning and just talking about. You write at one point, the Putin regime is autocratic and ruthless, but cannot completely seal off Russian society. That feature of 20th century totalitarianism is no longer possible in our time. Explain what you're saying there and why that's true.
There's a lot of evidence that the informal media, the Putin regime, has undeniably cracked down, especially on television and radio and newspapers, but especially TV. But like water going around barriers in our age, in contrast to a lot of the 20th century, you can't really close off information. And there's a very active internet. Even in North Korea, this is a factor to a degree. There's a very active black market, including CDs and lots of printed material and DVDs. The regime in China has the Great Firewall, which works to a significant degree but doesn't work completely. And they're extremely reluctant. I know this from direct experience with students of ours, whom I won't name on the air, a great sideline, a great avocation for Chinese and foreign young people is getting around the Great Firewall, and they do it, and the regime does not crack down. That would be a real public relations disaster, and political as well, if they did.
You also mentioned in the column that it's not just a matter of this global media thing that is all but impossible to make impregnable, but also that the fact that we are really in this undeniable global economy now. And so even someone like Mr. Putin needs to think about what he does, the statements he makes in terms of how those affect other nations with whom Russia wants to have strong and positive economic relations. I mean,
yes. And that's why economic sanctions, which not just Republicans but others will minimize in terms of being too timid or too limited, the U.S., European, and to some extent global. Australia, New Zealand, and other countries, Japan, Korea, are cooperating with us. These sanctions on Russia really do have an impact. Putin's obviously enormously talented as well as ruthless, and the fact that he's been able to get so much mileage out of the Russian machine, not just the war machine, the fact that he's been able to be so assertive in so many ways on this miserably disorganized, weak, and inefficient economy, which is rapidly becoming weaker with the rapid decline in oil prices. They're heavily dependent. McCain likes to talk about them being a gas station. That's a vital source of income for them. The fact that he's been able to get so much mileage out of this terribly damaged and inefficient vehicle is quite impressive, but it shows the importance of economic leverage. It's a complicated subject, which I don't fully understand. I know that because I'm trying to write about it in more depth. I did get an article published in 2012 in the journal International Affairs developing the theme that Germany is becoming so powerful today in positive ways, thank God, because economic leverage is at least as important, if not more important, than military leverage in our era of a globalized economy. And it's why the U.S., for all our missteps, remains so singularly powerful in the world. It's economic influence and everything that relates to that, not just traditional military power.
And just this morning on NPR, mention was made of the drastic effects that on for instance Russia, if for instance the flow of oil out of Iran should be in a sense opened up again, that would really change the dynamic of the situation in a market where the oil prices have already fallen. Very likely they would fall still further.
Putin has been extremely active and to a degree effective in Mideast diplomacy. Russia is one of the six partners with us in negotiations with Iran. Republican mischief in the letter that we started the program discussing could very well provide him with an opportunity to operate much more independently vis-a-vis Iran as he is vis-a-vis Syria, although Syria giving up nuclear, chemical weapons, while it was a result of Secretary Kerry's initiative, it was Putin who really grabbed the ball. I don't know the degree to which they worked in tandem, but Putin's diplomatic initiatives are quite remarkable, along with using the Russian army, given the weak foundation on which he's standing. In a tough environment, there are lots of people gunning for Putin, so to speak, in Russia.
Right. Let's finish up close to home with a couple of political matters, actually right here in the state of Wisconsin, and I know you follow these events closely, even though you happen to live in Illinois, where also things politically get pretty interesting sometimes. But
I work in Wisconsin, and this is where I get paid.
Absolutely.
The family homes in Illinois.
Right. Probably one of the biggest stories on the state front was the passage of right-to-work legislation, which of course, is expected to have the effect of very seriously undermining the presence and effectiveness of unions in the workplace. Were you surprised by that development, and what kind of long-term effects, in fact, do you think that legislation is likely to have?
Well, I wasn't surprised given the governor's posture. I'm confident he hopes it will give him a boost in with the party base and with the Sun Belt states, which are generally right-to-work states, more than more northern states like Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan. The U.S. labor movement has been in decline for a very long period of time. It may boomerang in the sense that the Democratic Party benefits from certain employee unions that are robust and strong. The Service Workers Union, the Teamsters Union, which is enormously powerful, run by the son of Jimmy Hoffa, a very admirable man in many ways and living in a much easier environment than his father operated in. For historical reasons, given the intense animus between the father and the Kennedy brothers, the Teamsters have from time to time been Republican. I believe that's faded since the 70s. But Walker's move, clever as it seems, may well boomerang in the sense that unions still have some clout and it may reinforce or bring new relations with the Democratic Party. That's trying to add something to discussion. That's something I've thought about, and we'll see. But I don't think right to work is as controversial as it used to be. And with the decline of unions nationally compared to the period from the 30s into the 60s, unions aren't as controversial, they're not nearly as powerful as they were, and right to work, if you're going to become president of the United States, you got to do more than excite the base. You've got to reach out to people who are not highly political. And I think for the working people of the country, and they really elect presidents, it's not the 1%, and it's not money. It really isn't. Alone, I think it may well boomerang. As Walker faces more and more of an unfriendly national combative context.
Right. You also are following with great interest the possibility that a certain man named Russ Feingold might be re-entering the political fray.
Well, I read that in the paper, I believe, and probably heard it on NPR.
But this is somebody you happen to admire quite a lot, so I suppose this is something you are excited about.
Oh, yes. He... Well, we were talking off the air. I don't agree with him for whatever that's worth, but I really admire his independence as well as intelligence. I really admire his maverick status and the fact that he was the one member of the Senate who voted against the Homeland Security Act first time around, and he reminds us of that, and he's quite right to do so. I really admired that at the time. I think he's a great lively presence, and according to the Kenosha News, within the last couple of days, he runs quite well against Senator Johnson.
Interesting.
Yeah, I hope he goes back. He's been doing very good work for our country without a lot of publicity for the State Department in Africa, and that will only help whatever he does or decides to do in the future.
Very good.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. It shows there's life in the Democratic Party.
Well, it's good to have you here to bandy about on all these really important issues, and look forward to your return visit in the month of April.
Good. Well, I'm glad you like banding about. That's good.
I do, especially with you. Professor Art Sear, a director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College. Dave Cole handed me a news release, and I did want to make sure that I mentioned a presentation going on at Carthage tonight as part of something called the Diversity Summit. Rabbi Irwin Kula is going to be giving a presentation tonight called Beyond Tolerance, the Indeterminacy of Truth, and the Too Muchness of Our Identities. Very timely topic, obviously, an important presentation that is free and open to the public tonight. Again, 7 p.m. in the Todd Weir Center. That is the building where the student union was formerly housed, room 128C. Again, that is tonight at 7 p.m. on the campus of Carthage.
Starting with President Woodward, diversity is, as you well know, among our very highest priorities. And Sandy Basigli and others on the faculty and staff and among our students have really done a great job of developing the Diversity Summit.
Very good. It's a great, and important issue. So, Professor Sear, again, thank you for joining us today on The Morning Show.
Thank you, Professor.
Great to have you here. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, my conversation with Dr. Angelo Valandez, author of The Conversation, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care. Dr. Valandez works with terminal patients and has come to really believe that undue medical intervention in late in life, in many, many cases, simply prolongs suffering and difficulties, and believes that if more open and frank, heartfelt conversations about these issues can happen before the moment of crisis sets in, much better decisions can be made about end-of-life care. Our conversation will be coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show. And on Friday, I'll be speaking with Mark Crispin Miller, who is a media studies professor in New York City and the editor of something called the Forbidden Bookshelf Project, which re-releases important or controversial books that have either fallen out of print or perhaps in some cases even been suppressed in one way or another. My conversation with him will be coming up on Friday's Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. If you are interested in rehearing any previous conversations on The Morning Show, you are invited to go to our website, which is wgtd.org, and click on Talk. Just a reminder that among the interesting morning shows that have aired as of late is the Monday Morning Show, in which I re-aired a conversation with Carthage College's former football coach, Tim Rux, who recently passed away quite suddenly and unexpectedly. My conversation with him from 2004, the year that the football team went all the way to the national playoffs in Division III football, that conversation is archived for the Monday Morning Show. Again, you can hear that by going to WGTD.org and clicking on Talk. Our weather forecast calls for mostly sunny skies today. For the early part, a few clouds rolling in later with a high of 45 degrees, overnight low of 30. Tomorrow's high again in the low to mid-40s.